Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I am joining you today 10 years after the referendum in the UK about whether to continue on as a member of the European Union or leave and pursue a new course. And with me to discuss how that worked and also some very recent developments are Bruegel's own Heather Graby and Richard Corbett. Richard is someone who has seen the EU from all sides. He has been a member of the EU's bureaucratic corps, passing the exams to join that group, and then he became a politician. He was a member of the European Parliament from the UK to the EU. At one point, he became an advisor to the very first president of the European Council, which is the Council of EU leaders that meets to make important decisions. And then after that, went back into the European Parliament and was in the last group of UK MEPs to serve and was the head of the Labour Party delegation there. The Labour Party is of particular interest because they currently hold the prime ministership of the United Kingdom, are in the process of changing who that person is. So, Richard, can you tell us, just to get us started, what is going on in the UK right now and how does this affect relationships with the EU? We're also, you know, on the other side of Brexit.
Well, as you know, the UK is a parliamentary system, and the party that has a majority in Parliament forms the government when there is a single party majority, which there usually is. And that party is free to decide, if it wants to change prime minister. That happened a lot under the previous Conservative governments, a succession of prime ministers. It's not been so typical when you've had Labour governments, but clearly a majority in the Parliamentary Labour Party, the members of Parliament, feel that it's right at this point to change prime minister.
And so who has it been and who are we changing to and what does that mean for London, Brussels?
Well, it has been Keir Starmer, and it will be known to most of you, our audience, who, when it comes to Brussels, I think you mean the EU, has pursued a course of what he calls a reset, of slowly and step by step getting closer to the European Union, removing some of the barriers that were thrown up by the withdrawal agreement. Andy Burnham is likely to be the new Prime Minister, almost certainly, in a few weeks' time. He's been Mayor of Greater Manchester, not at the front line of international affairs, therefore. And although he has said that he hopes Britain will rejoin the EU in his lifetime, I think he means his political lifetime, he's not yet spelt out how he would go about that. And in fact, he kept somewhat off that subject in the recent by-election, which was needed to get him into Parliament.
Thanks for that. Heather, walk us through the last 10 years. We had a referendum, which was sort of a surprise that it was happening and a surprise how it turned out. And then there was a preparation process to actually start Brexit, the process of Britain exiting the European Union, which eventually they did. And ever since, there's been this constant talk about renegotiation without actually changing much.
No, and by this point in time, the EU is pretty comfortable with the arrangements that have been made over the years, and it's the UK that is on the demand side for moving things forward. And that, of course, does affect the dynamics of the relationship. By now, the EU has lots of other priorities, you know, Russia, the United States, China. And so the priority to the UK is much lower than it was. Now, between 2016, the referendum in June that year, and 2020, when the UK actually left the EU, the negotiations were pretty intense and it was a much higher priority issue. Because unscrambling the British egg from the omelette was a really complicated thing to do for both sides. And there was a lot to negotiate because the UK was an important member state, a large one, and fully part of the single market. But by the time that deal was done, and there were successive prime ministers who did the deal, in the end it was Boris Johnson who was the prime minister. The EU had mostly got what it wanted, which was ensuring continued trade with the UK, including financial services, really important part of the UK economy. And also ensuring some key things like the rights of European citizens in the UK and vice versa, but also Northern Ireland. and the Republic of Ireland, because one of the biggest and most contentious questions in the negotiations was, where is the hard border? Is the border between the UK and the EU along the border of Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, so on the land border, or is it in the Irish Sea between the rest of the UK, so England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland? And that makes a huge difference in terms of customs procedures, for example, the status of the people of Northern Ireland, and of course, trade between the UK and the Republic of Ireland. So in the end, the border is in the Irish Sea, which means that there are special arrangements for the island so that trade can continue across that border, which of course historically has been a source of tensions and indeed violence. So it's really important, that particular border. And that has meant then a lot of unresolved issues, which they've slowly moved on regarding food standards. And there remained quite a lot of unresolved issues which have become increasingly important to the UK. So one is about youth mobility, for example, also energy, because the North Sea has become more important over that time period because of the growth of renewables, wind farms in the North Sea and so on, and the need to connect up the grids. So things have moved a bit, but that fundamental agreement was basically done for 2020 and it has held.
Richard, you were telling us right before we started recording that the UK has three really strong reasons to reset and think about getting closer with the EU again. Can you walk our listeners through what those are?
Yeah, the first is that public opinion has not done what many politicians anticipated, that once Brexit had actually happened, the public would say, OK, that's done, we'll acquiesce. On the contrary, over 60% of those who have a view one way or the other now say that Britain should rejoin the European Union. Second reason is that Brexit has not turned out to be anything like what it was sold to be by those who supported it. But the economic cost of Brexit, and it's turned out to be a cost, has been even bigger than anticipated. Some of the latest studies say British economy is up to 8% smaller than it would have been, a figure that the Chancellor has recognised as being valid or likely to have been valid. That in turn means for anybody in government, that's a loss of up to £90 billion a year of tax revenue every year. When the whole country is in a debate, can we afford to spend £5 billion extra here or on defence or £3 billion more on the health service or can we save something here and we need money for infrastructure, this and that? £90 billion is a huge difference. So the economic consequences of Brexit are really sinking in. And the third reason is the new geopolitical situation. Since Brexit, we've had an aggressive, military aggressive Russia to the east of the continent, and we now have an unreliable and frankly sometimes dangerous USA to the western side. So all European countries in and out of the EU are beginning to realize that we share common interests and common values. It's not just in Britain that this is provoking a new debate. Look at what's happening in Iceland with a referendum next in August on whether to reactivate negotiations to join the EU. The debate's opening again in Norway. Every single West Balkan country is in the process of negotiating its entry. Moldova, Ukraine, the EU's considering a fast-track procedure for Ukraine as a possibility. So regrouping inside the European Union in this geopolitical situation is the third reason why the Brexit debate has not died in Britain. It's, on the occasion of the 10th anniversary, been reanimated with an active debate about whether we might consider rejoining.
What did the EU look like when you were sitting around the table or on the side of the table where the EU leaders were gathered discussing the highest policies? How did you feel the EU, the national leaders within the EU worked together?
It's always interesting to see a European Council meeting. And the European Council brings together the heads of state or government of the member states with the president of the commission. And the way the first full-time president, Herman Van Rompuy, former Belgian prime minister, organized it was to say, OK, let's sit around the inner table, just the prime ministers, no foreign ministers next to them, as there used to be, no advisors next to them, create a sense of collegiality and shared responsibility. We are the countries of Europe who are highly interdependent, whether we like it or not. We have common problems, which we can solve better together in most cases. In many cases, we can only solve jointly. So let's hammer this out together. There was despite the different political backgrounds and geographical backgrounds of the different prime ministers and presidents, that creating that sort of atmosphere to get a result was very important.
And was the UK involved in the treaty change that it took to get the European Council in its current form started?
Yes, the European Council had initially been set up as an informal body, and then it was recognised in the treaties, and it was the last revision of the treaties known as the Lisbon Treaty, which formalised having a full-time president. Before, they took it in turns to be president, so every second meeting you had a different chair, there was no continuity. And frankly, to chair European Council meetings, it's the most difficult European institution to chair because you had 28 prima donnas around the table, people used to getting their own way in a national context, and suddenly they're in a meeting where they can't do anything unless they all agree. So preparing those meetings, talking to everybody beforehand, putting a text on the table, adjusting it, negotiating a compromise, knocking heads together, very time-consuming. If you're prime minister of a country at the same time, you don't have time to do that properly. So having a separate full-time president that they all chose together, one of them, Belgian Prime Minister, gave up his job to become president of the European Council, with the time to do that was an important change. And yes, Britain was fully on board with that change. It ratified it and it wasn't controversial.
There was even talk of Tony Blair, who was Prime Minister at the time, becoming the first European Council president. How very much times have changed.
So, Heather, you came to the EU context with an eye toward enlargement, towards adding countries. And you've seen some of that in your time in the institutions and later in think tank world, but you've also now seen subtracting one. What's your sense of how this has shifted over the years?
Well, enlargement policy has evolved a lot over the years, and it will continue to evolve, which has a huge impact on the prospects for the UK rejoining. The UK would not be joining through the kind of process it had in the early 1970s. UK joined in 1973 when the EU was essentially a common market with an agricultural policy, not even a regional policy much at that point. And it didn't have any of the euro or the Schengen area of passport-free travel. It didn't have a single market. It didn't have, hundreds of thousands of pages of law, which have evolved since then. But even since that time when the UK was a member, the EU has evolved further still. And now that there are 9 countries essentially in the queue for enlargement, and the EU is already in active negotiations with the 6 Western Balkan countries, as well as Ukraine and Moldova, Iceland may join them after a referendum that they're intending to have. It means that the dynamic situation will change a lot over the next years, and that will affect what the EU is willing to accept in any kind of negotiation with the UK, whether that's to rejoin or other changes in the relationship. So there are a number of things that will change. One is that whatever happens for Ukraine, that could actually be quite helpful for the UK, because I think it's likely that the EU will sometime this year or next year come up with a special arrangement for Ukraine, particularly on security, that might be extendable towards the UK. So the involvement of Ukraine in some kind of European Security Council or some kind of discussion and decision-making forum on big security issues, where the UK, as having major defence assets and being a major security player, would also be relevant. So I think that could be quite helpful. But there are other parts of the Ukraine accession process that could set precedents which are unhelpful for the UK. For example, I think it's quite likely the EU is going to rule out any kind of fast track, any kind of shortcuts for Ukraine as regards taking on all of the EU rulebook, what's called the acquis communautaire. The Ukraine will have to abide by all kinds of things that the UK has historically not been terribly happy with. So free movement of labour, but also issues to do with the EU budget. That will change as a result of Ukraine joining, but that won't make it easier for the UK to join. And we also see other third country agreements, not just enlargement, but third country agreements that set precedents. So, for example, the EU negotiated a new arrangement with Switzerland, which will go for a referendum in Switzerland, which involved the Swiss having to swallow something that's politically very difficult for them, which is free movement of labour. That was hard, and it will still go to a referendum. If it passes that referendum, the EU absolutely cannot offer something different to the UK, because that would be then unacceptable to the Swiss with this arrangement. So that means free movement of labour remains an absolutely core part of the single market. If the UK wanted to, say, rejoin the single market without rejoining the EU, they would have to accept free movement of labour. Plus the fact that, you know, the whole enlargement process and even the relationship with third countries like Norway, it's about rule taking. If you're Switzerland or Norway and you want to trade with the EU, basically as a member of the single market, you have to accept all of the EU's rules without having any say in shaping those rules. And you have to accept free movement of labour, and you have to make a contribution to the EU budget of some kind. I think that last one is solvable. It doesn't have to be to the EU budget. It could be a special fund like Norway has, where Norway has control over how that money is spent. So there are ways of solving that. But those three sticking points of the budget contribution, migration, free movement of labour, and then the rule taking, they're not going to go away. They're not going to get easier as a result of enlargement and other policies for third countries. I think the EU could actually become more rigid on those points.
Yes. The halfway house of being in the single market but not a full member indeed makes you a rule taker, which in the short run is not perhaps a big problem, because most of the rules were set when Britain was still a member. But as time moves on and the EU updates its rule book, of course you would want a say, which is one reason why there's a renewed debate about whether Britain should go the whole way and become a full member. Now, could that go quickly? As a former member, it's still largely aligned with EU rules. Where there is divergence, it's well documented. You know exactly what it is, and the issue can be addressed. I remember when Finland joined, it was similarly already aligned with EU rules by virtue of the EEA agreement, and it took 2 years to negotiate. From application to actually concluding the negotiations was 2 years, basically. So, okay, add a little bit extra, it's possible. But what are the tricky issues? Heather mentioned them. Would Britain have to join Schengen? It's interesting, by the way, that in Britain, those who are opposed to joining, you know, the Brexit supporters, they don't talk about the benefits of Brexit anymore, because there aren't any. They say, oh yeah, but they wouldn't have us back, or it's too difficult, or we'd have to do this and that. Well, would we? Ireland is not in Schengen either, and there were actually, for once, objective reasons. It wasn't just ideological that Britain and Ireland didn't join Schengen as islands with limited points of entry, unlike a land border where you can go in right through the forest. And once you're in, there's no checks because there's no system of identity cards or official addresses. So it made sense. Cyprus is also not in Schengen. The euro. There are now five member states. There are six member states not in the euro, but five of them show no intention of ever joining. And there's no deadline. So would that really be an issue? Would the EU insist, no, we've got to have a deadline for you? I'm not sure that they would. And the third one Heather mentioned is freedom of movement, which indeed, even to rejoin the single market, that's one of the four freedoms. But there it needs a debate in Britain, because most migration to Britain is from outside Europe, outside the EU, which is almost entirely a matter for national rules, not EU rules. The one EU rule that affects it, actually, paradoxically, is one that would appeal to people who are worried about high levels of migration. It concerns the small proportion of migrants to Britain who are asylum seekers. Under the EU's rules, you can ask an asylum seeker to go back to the first EU country they first entered to be processed there, which is why the small boat problem only arose after Brexit. So that's on non-EU migration. EU migration, freedom of movement, is actually much smaller numerically, and it's not an unconditional right. You move to another country on condition that you find work, usually within 3 months, or you prove you are self-sufficient and not a burden on the state. That's much more acceptable to those people who are concerned about numbers of people coming in. They're coming in to work, to do a job. We need them in many cases. Usually the EU ones were coming in for a few years, going back after a few years, didn't bring their family with them, unlike migrants coming now from around the world. So that debate, look at it rationally, is actually not so bad for Britain. The challenge is explaining that. It's a complicated explanation. You need time on the doorstep in a referendum or whatever to say, hang on a minute, think about it. And that is a big challenge when faced in the era of one-line slogans and tweets and whatever in politics. To come back with an explanation is a challenge. But surely it's doable given the magnitude of the prize of getting back in.
You do make it sound so logical, but I've also seen that in UK politics, the principle of the thing can take over from the substance of the thing. And particularly when it comes to the euro, for example. While I agree with you that Britain might not be pushed to join the euro quickly, I can't imagine it getting another explicit opt-out like it had before. So Britain would at least need to sign a piece of paper saying we'll look at it eventually, and it might need to rejoin the ERM as it had been the rates mechanism that it was part of and then withdrew from.
Maybe. I'm sure you're right that the beginning of the negotiations, the EU would say, yes, you've got to give some kind of commitment. But would the EU really, if this became a breaking point in the negotiations, would they insist on it given the situation inside the EU that not all countries are in the euro? It's in the EU's interest to get Britain back in for three reasons. One, Brexit hurt them as well economically, not as much as Britain, but losing a large chunk of the single market was bad. Two, the new geopolitical situation. They also have an interest on Britain rejoining and being on the inside. And thirdly, very simply, if the one member state ever to have left comes back a few years later and says, oh, sorry, we made a dreadful mistake. Would you please have us back? That, after all, is a vindication of why we created the EU and Europe, why we need this common body in our continent to work together, to solve problems jointly together. It would be a feather in the cap of the EU. So I think there would be some leeway in the negotiations, as Michel Barnier himself said last week when he came to London. So I think there's some scope for that.
I think it would be impossible for the EU to refuse if the UK came and said, we want to join. After all, we have Article 49 of the treaty that says any European country can apply to join. So within the treaty of the EU, it's impossible to refuse, and it would be a big gain for all the reasons that Richard has said. But once you actually have the UK application to join accepted, things get more sticky. I think one is there wouldn't be any kind of explicit opt-out. In practice, you know, as we've just discussed, there's no real pressure on countries to join the euro until they want to. But the UK would have to sign up in theory to everything. There would be no opt-outs, no rebate on the budget, none of these things that the UK had before. And after all, let's not forget that other countries have domestic politics too. It's not only the UK. So the domestic politics in France might be rather unfavourable to accepting the UK. After all, let's not forget that General de Gaulle, as president of France, refused the UK on several occasions before it eventually joined in 1973. And there might well be French politicians who say, absolutely not, this is not in our interest. There are other member states that would welcome the UK because they have a similar free market orientation in their economic policies. Think about Sweden, for example, and the Netherlands, which were always much more closely aligned with UK positions on the single market. And there are a lot of countries that see the security and defense advantages of having the UK back in. That's become much more important than it was in the past, because in the past, NATO was the main venue where security and defense were decided and agreed. But yeah, things are changing a lot with the US position. So I think there will be reasons why countries would like the UK to come in, but domestic politics could get very tricky. And let's not forget that every member state has to ratify every single accession treaty. So that means the French Parliament, as well as all the other parliaments, would have to vote for the UK to rejoin. So it does get more complicated. Plus, the EU has moved on to do things that it never did during UK membership, which are rather different from the kind of thing that the UK would have agreed to. For example, joint borrowing to fund economic recovery after COVID. They've also got a jointly funded defence loan programme, which the UK is allowed to join, but has been rather cautious and rather slow about joining. So these kinds of things mean that a lot of member states of the EU are moving on, and they'd have to look afresh at the UK and what would it mean for their position in the EU. And after all, the UK is a big country. You know, all of the countries that have applied to join now, so the six Western Balkans plus Ukraine and Moldova, all of those countries added together are not the population of the United Kingdom. So it's a lot of countries that would join, but the Brexit-shaped hole in the EU is rather large, and rejoining would have strategic as well as economic implications for all of the current member states. So I can see why particularly the northwestern members of the EU would be very keen to have much more North Sea cooperation with the UK for all the renewable energy, connect up the grids, have a great deal more energy infrastructure as well as energy market integration. There's a lot to gain for example, Ireland and other countries to sort out the problems with food standards so that the trade can improve. There are definitely member state interests in specific parts of cooperation with the UK where they might want bigger integration. But as soon as you start talking about membership, a whole load of other domestic issues will arise. And that's why the demandeur is always going to be the UK itself rather than the EU side.
And the vibe of that is going to be important. If the UK comes back and says, we've made a dreadful mistake, we'd like to rejoin, they would get a very different reception than if they said, you know, you need us, make us an offer. It's hard for me to see that second approach bearing the kind of fruit that some people might hope it would.
Yes, I think you're right on that. But the tone of the debate on this in Britain is about the mistake we have made, and can it be rectified without encountering the sort of problems that Heather just described?
I think it's going to take a new political generation. It'll be the young people who maybe voted for the first time when they voted in the referendum or were too young to vote in the referendum. They are the ones who will end up asking the question, wait a minute, what is the balance of pros and cons? What are our interests in rejoining the EU? And looking at it with fresh eyes, not the same old stale debate that went round and round in Britain and are still going round to a large extent around migration from other EU countries. That's, I think, would be much less controversial among the younger generation, the economic opportunities, the need to team up with like-minded countries in an increasingly geopolitically contested and dangerous world, frankly, the need to look at joint challenges like climate impacts, you know, heat waves affecting all of Europe, but also storms affecting the whole of the Atlantic coastline, about global warming, but it's also about sea level rise. There are a lot of common challenges, the need to keep increasing renewable energy production. These are all areas where there are really deeply common interests, where the UK has much more the same way of thinking about how to deal with these challenges than it does with the US now, as well as other Commonwealth countries, for example. But this new generation will need time to think through these issues. And I think it will be a new political generation in terms of the representatives of the people in Parliament who would also be bringing this. It's notable how Andy Burnham, who, as you rightly pointed out earlier, he said, I would like to see the UK rejoin the EU within my lifetime. He didn't specify that would be within his political career. So he's kicking this into the long grass, I suspect.
When politicians talk about their lifetime, they mean their political lifetime, surely.
But I hope so. But I suspect it could be, for example, mayors, former mayors, who talk about this in a different way, because the same old debates will lead to the same old outcomes.
The mayor of London is very explicit, for instance, as well. But I think you hit on a very important point there, the demographic point, because this shift of opinion in Britain is not just Leave voters who say, hang on, this bears no resemblance to what I was promised. And it's also generational. If you look at the age profile of how people voted 10 years ago, it was overwhelmingly the over 70s that were the most in favor of leaving, and anybody under 35 was in favor of joining. So 10 years later, even if nobody had changed their mind, mathematically, there's a certain number of elder ones who have sadly left us, and there's 10 more years of younger people getting on the electoral register. And it's not because you get Europhobic when you get older. This is a cohort factor. It's the era you grew up in. And so this trend is not going to go into reverse by definition. So over time, the 62% who now say they want to rejoin will creep up to 64, 66, 68, which will make it easier for British governments to be a little bit less cautious on this.
And specifically, the demographics of England are key because it's England and Wales that voted to leave. Scotland voted to remain. Northern Ireland voted to remain in terms of majorities. So the demographics in the regions of England become very important. And the expectations of where Britain's economic growth and economic opportunities will come from in the future become important. I think there was a lot of nostalgia for a period when, among the leave voters, for a period when Britain was a much bigger economy in the world, when it was an empire. Some of the over 70s voted because of that. And also when it had more economic ties with countries which frankly see the UK as a rather small country now. For example, India. It became much harder to sign free trade agreements and other things with countries beyond the EU than people were promised during the referendum.
And Britain discovered that when it left the EU and it had to make its own trade deals across the world to replace the ones that it previously had via the EU as a member, it discovered that coming along negotiating just as Britain, without the leverage of the world's largest single market and largest trading bloc in those negotiations, it had much less leverage. It struggled even to replicate the deals that it previously had via the EU.
What was the vibe like in 1973? Do you remember?
Vaguely, I was young, but I remember especially the 1975 referendum. And it was controversial at the time. It was when Britain first joined, was first getting into this process of European integration. Some of the Brexiteers now said, oh yes, but we were only joining a common market. It was a free trade area, now not what it is now. If you go back and look what was said at the time, both Edward Heath, when he was Conservative Prime Minister, and Harold Wilson, Labour Prime Minister, they both said, no, this is a political process. We need to be part of it. This is uniting Europe in a way that it has never been before. After centuries of tearing each other apart on the battlefields of Europe. It's a new way of doing things. It was very clearly a political process. And people voted for it by a very large majority then. It was 2/3 to 1/3.
It's amazing. I want to talk more about the movement of people, because that tends to be the biggest sticking point. People talk about movement of goods or goods and services, the single market, the customs union, but there seems to be a real red line around the subject of moving for jobs, moving for asylum, moving for any reason, really, even things that from the outside look like this should be fairly straightforward, like touring musical artists or students, is still very, very difficult. Heather, I'd love to get your thoughts on this. And you mentioned English politics. You know, when I see these England rallies and people with the red and white flags, they're not all old. A lot of them are younger. To me, it's very hard to understand why there is so much hardline opposition, even to what seems like fairly ordinary cross-border moving around.
Well, across the whole of Europe, including the UK, immigration remains a hugely important political issue. It's very controversial. We've seen the growth of populist radical right parties, which have largely made migration their primary issue. This is not just in the UK. This is all over the place. We're going to have a French presidential election next year where immigration will again be really important. Giorgia Meloni used that a lot in coming to power in Italy, etc. So this is not unique to the UK. What is rather unique to the UK is the way that this got tangled up with the issue of EU membership. Because in the UK, there was almost a deliberate elision of extra EU migration and intra-EU migration in the debate. So there were several things that were frankly mendacious claims. So one of the claims that was there in the campaign was that Turkey was just about to join the EU and that meant 80 million Muslims would have the right to come and live and work in the UK immediately. All nonsense in terms of the likely time frame and also the way that the negotiations could have turned out on free movement of labour. There were also, the referendum happened in 2016 in the middle of or just after an enormous immigration crisis into the whole of Europe, one where lots of countries were facing difficulties in dealing with a large number of asylum seekers at the same time, as well as a large number of economic migrants. Now, since that time, many things have changed in lots of European countries. In fact, most European countries have moved towards a more restrictive set of policies, both as regards labor immigration and also their asylum systems. but everybody has their obligations to accept asylum seekers. As Richard pointed out earlier, that ironically, the UK gained more difficulties in terms of the small boat arrivals because it no longer cooperates with France, where France would process asylum claims as the country where people had already arrived, rather than allowing them to go on to the UK, something called the Dublin Convention. And in fact, by leaving the EU, the UK left all of the cooperation and the requirement of other countries to take back asylum seekers. But we can now see that in many countries, there's talk about processing asylum claims outside the EU. Everybody's moved essentially to the right on extra EU, so migration. That is, people coming into the EU from outside Europe. But what is not controversial in most of the other countries, there are some issues, but much, much less controversial, is the issue of other EU citizens moving to live and work in a member state. Richard mentioned earlier that, you know, you have the right to go and live and work in any other EU member state, provided you have the means to support yourself. Either you have a job, or you're going to get one within 3 months, or you have some independent means. And that, generally speaking, is uncontroversial. There's a little bit of it. There have been, of course, you know, the famous Polish plumber after Poland joined in 2004. But on the whole, labour mobility in Europe is not that high, and that's not controversial. What's controversial is people coming from outside Europe.
And it's actually going down.
Indeed, it's diminished. But in the UK, there's still this kind of muddle. And that too, when you look at opinion polling in the UK, it wasn't the Spanish doctors in the NHS or German nurses or, you know, people from the EU teaching in British universities that were controversial, actually. It was this idea of take back control, that somehow Britain would get new kinds of control over its immigration by leaving the European Union. But in practice, what's happened is that immigration into the UK has increased, actually by rather a lot, from the rest of the world. And then, meanwhile, the Spanish doctors and the German university professors, some of them have stayed and they've got British citizenship or they've got right to remain. Some have left the UK. But this migration issue muddle, which a lot of it was based on false claims during the referendum, it's very hard to put it to bed now.
But it's such a classic example of where opinions are fairly friendly, but the voting is uncontroversially against. And I feel like we've seen some of this with post-Brexit questions about Remain. A lot of people say, well, I personally think it would be a great idea. And then if you wait, they say, but Brexit means Brexit and we left and I probably wouldn't vote the other way again because this has already happened. You know, the voting patterns don't as yet follow these shifts in public sentiment. I don't think, Richard. I mean, you're over there more than we are. What are you seeing?
Well, if you look at the tracker opinion polls that, you know, that ask every once a month exactly the same questions and exactly the same words on a whole shedload of issues, so they don't get much publicity always, they do show a very steady, slow but steady trend towards saying Brexit was a mistake and, furthermore, we should rejoin. So are people saying one thing and voting differently? It's easy to overinterpret the results of the recent local elections in Britain where Nigel Farage's party won a lot of local government seats, because Britain's electoral system explains that. His party was getting 25-26% of the votes and winning seats at that level because Labour, Conservatives, Liberal Democrats, Greens were all around 18%. But that also shows that if only 25-26% support Farage's party, that there's 75% that don't. So that apparent contradiction is largely to do with the British electoral system.
The US has a mostly two-party system, largely to avoid that fragmentation that you just said. The US also doesn't have a national ID card in the same way that European countries do, for most of the same legacy cultural reasons, which, as an aside, means that a lot of the current identification laws are running into this custom, because if you have ID for everyone, it's easier to ID yourself. But leaving aside the U.S. vagaries, this idea that you have the person who wins the election, it's very deeply baked in. Over in the continent, where people are used to parliamentary democracies, where oftentimes it's proportional representation, where you get a chunk of seats in the parliament based on your chunk of votes, and where you're used to having an ID card, there's just constant talk about maybe Britain is finally going to move to proportional representation. My sense is that people in Britain from the third parties have been talking about this for decades, but there's no real move to do it. What do you think?
Well, the Labour Party conference voted in favour of it. So even in the Labour Party, there is an active discussion about this. But remember, this is also a question of degrees. There are different forms of proportional representation. You don't have to have a single national constituency with no threshold like the Dutch do, with the result that there's 20 parties or whatever in the Dutch parliament. There are transferable vote systems. And don't think that the US is immune from this. When Al Gore lost the presidency to Bush Jr., that was largely because, or in part, because he'd lost a couple of percent of people who would likely have voted for him to the Green Party candidate who stood in the
election. It's true. So, from George Wallace to H. Ross Perot and to Ralph Nader, we have seen third-party candidates occasionally intervene in the U.S. system. But we haven't had a situation yet where that's really worked out great.
No, well, but it's worked. It's interfered sufficiently to cause the result of a president who had less than half the popular support becoming president, and quite controversial presidents at that.
But I think this issue will come back in the UK, potentially also in the US, but definitely in the UK, because basically politics is fragmenting the parties. We've had a two-party system. Well, in the 19th century, it was the Liberals and the Tories. In the 20th century, it was Labour and the Conservatives. But now we've got not only reform and then also there's restore. So there are several parties emerging on the far right in the most recent elections. But also the Green Party is gaining a lot of votes. And these big tent parties, both Conservative and Labour, are increasingly fractious big tents with lots of different opinions, not only on Brexit, but many other things as well. So it may be that it's the breakdown of the centre-right and centre-left and fragmentation that we see in many countries. This is not only in the UK. Also, you know, for example, the CDU and the SPD in Germany are losing votes in a big way to both the far right and to the far left. We see this in the French presidential election, while France has already lost a lot of historic parties. So I think this is a fundamental change in the post-war large two-party systems. This is not unique to the UK. What is rather unique is actually these two other issues that you mentioned, Rebecca. ID cards. The fact the UK has this absolute antipathy to having ID cards, but actually you need to have some form of identification more and more for everything. So that means that in the UK, it's quite hard to prove your identity. You need to have a utility bill for the last 3 months. You need to have a driver's license. You need to have various other things. This is becoming more and more complicated, and online you'll need to have some kind of digital ID soon enough. So it may be that the ID card issue will shift just because of the practicalities of modern life. But the other issue that is, we haven't mentioned yet, but which is actually rather important when it comes to accession, is when a country wants to join the EU asks, are you sure that you've got very clear separation of powers in your country that can ensure democracy and the rule of law and rights? Show us your constitution. Now, the UK doesn't have a written constitution. We have everything from Magna Carta to a common law system that...
Which is written. It's just not codified.
Yeah, which is exactly, it's written down, but it's not codified. So that actually is more of an issue than people have ever really talked about. And if the Conservative Party succeeds in doing what the current leader says, which is to leave the European Convention on Human Rights... That would really be a problem. If the UK left the human rights system in Europe, that would be a huge obstacle.
That would be a problem even now for because the withdrawal agreement and the deals that have been made between the UK and the EU presuppose that both sides are party to the Convention on Human Rights. And if one side tears that up, it affects the current relationship even.
Yeah, so legal divergence is an issue on lots of areas of regulation, but it's also, this is a very fundamental legal divergence if the UK were to do this. So the next elections will be important in seeing how far the UK moves apart.
We're coming to the end of our time. Richard, what are some closing thoughts you have for people in trying to understand relations? I know that you have spent your entire professional career helping Brits and continental Europeans work together, see how the other side views it. You have a natural tendency to be very optimistic. Realistically, where do you think we are?
As we're at the end, let's step back and look at the bigger picture. In Europe, we have a group of countries in close proximity, none of them large, we're all small or medium-sized countries, that are highly interdependent economically, ecologically. we are condemned to work together in a way, whether we like it or not. We have to work together to find common solutions to a whole range of problems that you cannot deal with adequately by yourself in your own corner. That fact means we have to overcome differences on how we work together, because it's a common need to work together. Over time, that fact is what encourages us all to find solutions to the problems we've just been discussing.
I totally agree. I mean, there is actually, ironically, given we're talking about divergence on rules, regulations and laws, but the convergence of interests in terms of like-mindedness in a period of massive geopolitical turbulence and increasing security threats, this is going to make it all the more important to work together. You know, we're all experiencing Russian sabotage and all kinds of attacks, hybrid warfare of different kinds. We're all facing Chinese economic competition and indeed coercion at times. We're all facing a really unpredictable and erratic US and concern to maintain the security order in Europe. All of those things are going to drive the interests closer together. The question is what forms of cooperation will work politically. And I think that's why at some point the UK probably will apply to rejoin. But I will bet Richard a bottle of champagne that it won't happen within the next decade. So we can reconvene in 2036 on The Sound of Economics and hear the champagne pop for one of us.
You've been listening to Bruegel's podcast, The Sound of Economics, available for free on all of your favorite podcast platforms, along with our writing and reports. We have been joined today by the fantastic Richard Corbett, also Bruegel's Heather Gravy. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. Thank you so much for spending this time with us, and see you on the next one.